Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Borderless podcast. This is your host, James Guzman. Thanks again for listening. This is the 101st episode, and so that's very exciting. I hope that everybody enjoyed the last podcast with all of the some of my favorite parts and bits and pieces of some of the last 100 episodes. So today, what we're talking about is the nation state to stateless nations, and we're going to tell you all about that. It's a very interesting conversation. First, I did want to talk about how you, if you're listening to this podcast, one thing that I hope you're using this information for is to bring more freedom and prosperity into your life. If you're trying to get past your own borders but running into roadblocks, I can personally help you. Let me tell you about Clarity.fm. Clarity is an amazing website which shows consultation calls from experts in all kinds of areas of expertise. If you want to speak to me directly, you can find me at Clarity.fm and schedule a call. Just go to the Clarity website and search my name, James Guzman, and book a convenient time. I would be happy to talk to you if you need help with any of the things that we talk about in this podcast, such as acquiring and managing short-term rentals, online business and marketing, moving abroad or living internationally, expat taxes, asset protection, and alternative investments. Even if I can't help you personally through the call, through my network of contacts, I can help you with just about any question or problem you're having in these areas. If you don't have anything specific, but you just want to talk to me about your business or plan, I would also happy to hear from you. With this podcast, I help to bring more freedom to the lives of as many people as possible. So help me help you by booking a call directly at clarity.fm, or you can sign up to the mailing list at borderlessblog.com, and you will get a free call as well as updates, discounts, and news about living a borderless life. Also, I'm planning on doing some live streams. So if you want to be up to date on that, get on the mailing list and you'll hear about that. I'll be bringing on guests, and you'll be able to live chat in questions and interact with us. And I think that's going to be pretty interesting. So back to the guest. Today I have on Tom W. Bell, and he earned a JD from the University of Chicago in 1993. And he then practiced law in Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C. before serving as a policy director at the Cato Institute. In 1998, he joined the faculty of Chapman University, Fowler School of Law, where he teaches all of his first-year common law courses and electives in high-tech and intellectual property law. Bell has published papers on copyright, internet law, polycentric law, prediction markets, and the Third Amendment. His books include Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good, and Your Next Government, From a Nation-State to Stateless Nation. Through Archimediate LLC, Bell designs, installs, and supports legal systems for special jurisdictions. Most recently, that work has taken him to French Polynesia, where he helped forge a memorandum of understanding to allow seasteading in that island paradise. Bell lives surrounded with books, guitars, surfboards, and smiling friends in the sunny beach of San Clemente, California. So I was very happy to have Tom on the podcast today, and I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Borderless Podcast, your guide to traveling, investing, and living beyond borders, where we talk about living the life that you want to live, where you want to live it.
Okay, Tom W. Bell, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
First of all, of course, you have the book, Intellectual, well, no, that's your old book. Let's talk about your new one. Your Next Government, From the Nation State to Stateless Associations. Now, I first became familiar with the idea of stateless associations through the book The Sovereign Individual. I thought it was a fascinating book. I read it in college, and it really kind of explains some other options or what it might look like in the future, what governance might look like and some other options. And if people haven't read that book, I really recommend it. And also, of course, you know, you've written a whole book about it as well. So maybe you could just kind of give us a general idea of from the nation state to stateless associations. What does that mean exactly?
Thank you for asking. So yes, the new book is Your Next Government, and the subtitle is From the Nation State to Stateless Nations. Actually, I prefer, James, the title you used, Associations, but Cambridge University Press, the publisher, told me it had to be Stateless Nations. Mm-hmm. But for that, they gave me the question mark. The question mark, Your Next Government, very mm-hmm. important in the book. It is not. Your next government. I'm not telling people this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm not, because I don't know. But I will, per your request, give you some broad themes that the book talks about. It is, by the way, you did mention, I get to mention my other book, because you mentioned it first, James, that my earlier book, and earlier book, I think it's the one just prior to this most recent one. Now, Your Next Government's the new one, but prior to that was Intellectual Privilege, about intellectual privilege, and that's about copyright. But we won't talk about that today. Mm-hmm. Back to YNG, Your Next Government. The big theme the book describes, which I think will be of most interest to you and your listeners, people who want to pursue opportunities on the world stage, kind of the digital nomad crowd, the big themes I think in Your Next Government they'll take the most interest in are, first of all, this revolution. It's a quiet revolution. It's transforming governments all across the world from the bottom up and inside out. Now, that's a bold claim. And I got to tell you, going into this book, I wasn't making it. It wasn't on my radar. And I sat down and I started looking at the facts. And wow, it just made my jaw drop. And I had to tell the world about it in this book. And so I did. So this is in reference to special economic zones. These are popping up in increasing numbers all over the world. They're getting more numerous. They're getting bigger. The latest one in Saudi Arabia, NEOM, is about the size of Connecticut. That's how big it is, a special jurisdiction where they're going to try out new kinds of laws, legal systems, really. Not just laws, whole new legal systems. And Dubai. You want to talk about big success stories, special jurisdictions. Dubai is a good example. Hong Kong for a long time was a kind of special jurisdiction. It still is. Shenzhen, you want to talk about growth opportunities in China. Now, I'm supposing your listeners are not going to rush to Shenzhen. Actually, some might. Actually, you could. Why not? Cost of living is low. They need help with a lot of stuff. They pay money just like everybody else. But anyhow, so these special jurisdictions are popping up all over the world. They're getting bigger. They're getting more diverse. They're fascinating in and of themselves. But I think for people who are willing to travel, there could be a lot of opportunities in finding these zones and helping them build out.
I think that the impression a lot of people have, maybe they've heard about it in the past, they've heard also about seasteading and some of these ideas of more privatized societies, this type of thing kind of popping up and trying out. And maybe they think that they haven't caught traction. Obviously, a lot of the ones that you just spoke about definitely caught a lot of traction.
Yes,
so
yes.
Are there some that maybe people haven't heard about? Because I know that there are a lot that maybe are not on most people's radar that people are trying, even if it's not, you know, everything, but they're trying new private markets in certain areas that have been successful.
Sure. I'll give you a three kind of snapshot. I'm not going to call these opportunities. It's a little premature for that. But I'll just say kind of like signals of potential opportunities. Mm-hmm. So three of them. They are in Honduras and in French Polynesia and in the Republic of Georgia. So I'll just go through them quickly. In Honduras, there is, on paper at least, a program for special jurisdictions called ZEDE, Z-E-D-E. And that's for Zonas Especial Desarrollo e Empleo, basically special development and employment regions. And they're still on paper. But on paper, they look really promising as business opportunities, not just for people who want to invest in a place where, you know, you can do things more cheaply than another place. Labor costs are going to be much lower there. Energy costs lower. It's not a perfect environment. But the important thing is in the zones they plan, there will be not just opportunities, but kind of first world governance opportunities. So the idea is that here's the way to think about it. Your crowd should think about it this way. The idea is to create a place where there'll be a Starbucks and a WeWork and maybe a 24-hour fitness, because a lot of people in Honduras want those nice things that we take for granted. But those nice things don't happen in Honduras because, frankly, Starbucks and WeWork, et cetera, they don't trust the Honduran legal system. But in these ZAs, they actually want to create a common law legal system. So someday soon, they say they want to create Hong Kong and Central America. Think about that. Same time zone as Chicago. It's like in a warmer climate. It's in America's backyard. And they're basically running a common law legal system, which is, it's not the same. It's actually better. It's going to be better than the U.S. legal system. I say this, friend, as somebody who's been working on this project for a long time. So I won't pretend to be objective, but we're going to take the best of the U.S. legal system, its protection for rights and private property and contracts and the common law, and not import all the regulations, all the red tape, all the requirements of licensing before you can even earn an honest living. No. So it's going to be great. So that's Honduras. French Polynesia. I want to tell you about a guy there. His name is Chad Elwartowski. Elwartowski. And he's a friend of mine. He's a wonderful guy. He's one of these, like, I hope he doesn't mind if I say this. One of these guys, I'll just say he's done right with cryptocurrencies. Let's just leave it at that. He's done right with cryptocurrencies. And he loves seasteading. he is in French Polynesia because he and I and some other people, and I'm not foremost among them. Chad, I'm sure, is. But, you know, I've helped that. I've helped that with the legal stuff. French Polynesia is a site for seasteaders. And the project is still like the one in Honduras. All this stuff is like, you want the early word, right? If you're coming to the guy like me and I tell you this project is, you know, they're already turning their first billion, it's too late. So you're going to hear stuff that's kind of like way out on the horizon. And French Polynesia, the Seasteading Institute got an MOU. I helped them with that, an MOU, a memorandum of understanding with the government of French Polynesia to create seasteads in protected waters in that island nation. And right now, the seasteaders are looking for a site. They're talking with a number of different municipalities, really islands in French Polynesia. There's something like 162 islands in French Polynesia. Most of them are uninhabited. And the seasteaders want to, of course, do what seasteaders always want to do, build floating platforms. But they also want to have a special governance system. And that's something we're still working on. Chad is there. I think he's a good example because he's a digital nomad. He's a guy who made his money with cryptocurrencies, some of his money. He has many skills. I'm sure he's made money many ways, but that's one of his things. And he's actually he's moved to French Polynesia with his beautiful Thai wife, and he is helping to build seasteads there by talking to people, you know, building support on the ground, just being a guy on the ground. That's super important. And he's also a smart guy, going to be there if it takes off. And I bet you, Chad, is probably going to. Probably. Knowing Chad, you're probably going to have invested in some real estate nearby. So, and again, he'll make a killing because that's what he does. So there's French Polynesia. The last one is a little more speculative in a way in that it's kind of – no, I don't think it's more speculative. Actually, it's probably the most credible of them all. Yeah, let me totally rewind that because it has the best money behind it. It's got the backing of the biggest private bank in the Republic of Georgia. Now, you may be thinking, oh, Republic of Georgia, should I be impressed? Well, I'm not going to pretend it's the biggest country ever. But it is a legitimate big country in a very important place, actually. It is, by happenstance, actually, it's been there forever, but it's kind of coming up again, on one of the routes of the Silk Road. The Silk Road, the connection, the trade connections between China and Europe, you know, it's not just one road. It goes through all these different places. But Georgia in the Transcaucasus region is right there between the Black Sea to its west and the Caspian Sea to the east. And so it's not the only way to get through that kind of narrow passage, that part of the world, but it is a way. And there, I'll just stop and say, I really love the people I met in the Republic of Georgia. They're just pro-freedom, hardworking, they have an eye on the ball, they're looking to the future, and they're building this place, Anaklia, on the Black Sea. And I was out there, I guess it's 6 months ago now, to talk with people about creating a special jurisdiction there. And everything I heard, I got to catch up with them, but everything I heard then indicated that they wanted to institute the world's best practices for governance and law. So it's going to be rather like these Honduran Zetes, I think, or Dubai, or what the seasteaders wanted to do in French Polynesia. And that is basically bring in law from outside. And this for digital nomads and similarly kind of transitory smart business people is a great opportunity. It's a great opportunity. You folks are kind of like the migrating, you know, snowy swans that cover millions and thousands of miles every year. And you know, you got to have a special place to land. You want to have your kind of wetland, right? And that's what I think some of these places are building. If I have anything to say about it, because I want to have laws that people want to live under that help people do business. That's why Dubai has done well. And so they'll maybe create a little landing area for you folks there in the Republic of Georgia. And by the way, of all these places, I got to say that one, believe it or not, might have the best climate of all. Better than Honduras, better than French Polynesia. The Republic of Georgia on the Black Sea, it has the same climate classification as where I live now in Southern California. I live in Orange County, California, right next to the ocean. I love it. It's a beautiful climate. That's the same climate in the Republic of Georgia on the Black Sea in Anaklia. Right now, it's just a little bump in the road in Anaklia, but they are right now out there dredging a deep sea port. It's going to allow them to have big cargo going through there, and they're going to create a free trade zone kind of like Hong Kong.
Wow. And I'm curious as to what implications that has as far – well, what kind of power as far – I'm sure that they're different, each one, but will they be able to issue passports, will be able to incorporate there, that type of stuff, or is it just mostly for living there and having a business specifically there?
A lot remains to be, as you say, determined. I think everyone that I've spoken to about this everywhere, you know, agrees that more is better. It's kind of a bland way to put it. So the basically, I'll tell you this, the Honduran Zeti. So they probably on paper go as far as farther than anyone in giving governing responsibilities to the zones. Basically, the zones are under Honduran law as far as the constitution goes and as far as its international commitments. There's some provisions in particular of Honduran law, not constitutional, but part of its law that must be obeyed, such as those pertaining to the national anthem and its flag. You're not going to go disrespecting your host if you set up shop in a ZA in Honduras. But basically, beyond that, it's a lot of stuff. Basically, the ZA can have its own commercial law. So, yes, they could have their own articles of incorporation. They could have their own kind of a local visa regime. Sort of they could – and the seasetters want this too. They want to have kind of a way for digital nomads to come into the country but not into the visa and residency zone of the host country. So let me take a breath here, James. You mentioned this before we started our conversation. It's so my new book is Your Next Government, and it talks about the special economic zone. But now I want to introduce a new idea. I get a lot of ideas, and I write about them. The new idea is called the special international zone. So the book, Your Next Government, is about special economic zones and other special jurisdictions. And after I wrote the book, I mean, it's a 2018 book, but this stuff is happening quickly. After I wrote the book, I started to help start with some other people this new organization called the Institute for Competitive Governance. The Institute for Competitive Governance. And what ICG does is it seeks a better way to better government. And the better way it is promoting is competition. That's why we call it the Institute for Competitive Governance. And in my guise as the academic director of ICG, I published this paper. It's called Special International Zones in Practice and Theory. And so a special international zone is an area. I'll take a step back, James. If you think about a map, you think about, you know, it's like there's China and it's next to Mongolia. And there's a dark line between them. You know, that's the border. And if you go down there in a helicopter, you can kind of picture it on the ground. Maybe there's a fence or something. And you can actually, if you get down there on the ground, you can actually draw with a pencil, you know, where the line is. Okay, in theory, yes, but not in practice everywhere. Because many countries have now taken to kind of like splitting their borders. So I'll give you the example from the paper, from the real world that I talk about in the paper. France had all these economic migrants, is what France would call them, flying into De Gaulle Airport, Roissy De Gaulle Airport outside of Paris. And these would often be minors, sometimes minors. There would be these foreigners who would come in without a visa to visit France. And they would land in the airport and they'd have nowhere to go. They'd buy like a one-way ticket from like Libya to Roissy De Gaulle. And they get off the plane and they say, hello, France, here I am. I want to claim asylum because there's this international treaty, the Convention on Refugees, that obligates France and almost every other country in the world to give some succor, to give some aid to people seeking asylum, people who say, I am being persecuted, maybe prosecuted, but persecuted back home because of my ethnicity or my religion. I seek shelter. France did not want these people claiming asylum in France. Because why? Because then it has to give them all these rights. It has to let them hang around while there's a hearing, while they apply for asylum. It has to determine whether or not these people are really being persecuted back in Libya or wherever. France thinks these people are faking it, that they're economic migrants. So what does it do? It says, you're at the airport. The airport is not actually an asylum area. It is outside France, they say, for purposes of claiming asylum. You're in the international zone of the airport. So it's like France took their border and they split it and they pulled back the part of their border, the territory of France where you can claim asylum, you know, where you're in France for purposes of residency or visa, requiring a visa. Because when you're at the airport, if you're just passing through De Gaulle, you don't have to have a visa to visit France. You are in France, it's true, but you're flying from New York to Moscow and your plane just stops at Roissy De Gaulle and you change planes. You don't have to have a visa to visit France. It's the international zone. Are you still with me?
Yeah, I think that was the basis of that airport movie with Tom Hanks?
Yes, yes. So the idea now is these international zones, if you can split a border and roll back selectively the requirements for visas and residency permits and work permits, you can use this as a force for good. Here's how you do it. You say to a country like French Polynesia, hey, French Polynesia, we know you can't let just anybody walk in and set up shop and run a business and live here. We get it. But how about if we did it out here on the seastead, on this atoll? We screen people, and you let us just let in anybody we want. They have to have an additional okay to leave our atoll and come visit, you know, they don't have a mainland in French Polynesia, but, you know, to visit the main city, like in the island of Tahiti. It's Papeete is the capital, and that's where almost everybody lives. So that would be a special international zone for the seasteaders in French Polynesia that would let people like you, James, go fly there just because you, like, you know, filled out a form on Blue Frontier's website and you prove from your GitHub work that you're a good coder, and they run a credit check and there's no problem with your criminal background. Or maybe just have Oracle has hired you and Oracle says, we'll vouch for James. He's one of our employees and we're just done here. That's all it takes. As long as all you do is you fly out to our beautiful tropical island with a really fat connection to the rest of the world and all these cool people hanging out at Seastead, and why not just chill out there for a while? You will not find a more healthy, fun, beautiful environment with intelligent people. And that's the idea. And you never have to get the okay from French Polynesia. So that would be a special international zone. I'd like to see more of these, and I think they're coming down the pike that we're going to see more and more zones that not only have the power to have their own commercial code, their own courts. They're already doing this stuff. Dubai basically imported the common law of England and Wales, and they even hired retired judges, complete with the perukes, you know, those big wigs and the robes and everything. And so that's where we're headed, these special international zones, where I hope digital nomads like you and your listeners will be able to kind of skip all the formalities and red tape. You just want to go somewhere and work and be next to your client or just be in a nice climate, be around interesting entrepreneurial people. I think the world is coming where there's going to be an archipelago of these zones. And if I have if my plans, I won't say if I have my way. I'll say actually as I predict, if my predictions turn out correctly, Shall we look up James and look far to the horizon? You want the big picture view of where I see things going?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, let's hear it.
And I will tell you, this is a very shockingly optimistic view of the future. And before I launch into it, I just want to brace you for it by saying you're going to dig in your heels, and you should. But some of that digging in your heels is just good, healthy skepticism. But let's recognize there's something like a black swan in reverse effect here. Now, you know about the black swan, maybe, Nassim Taleb's idea?
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So humans are not we're just not wired up to plan for meteorite strikes, right? Those happen so rarely, it's kind of like not in our – literally, it's not in our DNA to worry about that. We worry about stuff rustling in the dark or loud noises or, you know, cold water or whatever. But we don't think about meteorite strikes. Those are black swan events. Well, I have posited the existence of golden swans. I talk about these in my book. And golden swans are events which are so implausibly great, we are just not wired up to expect them, to even understand them when they are happening. I think, in fact, we're kind of already seeing like gold goslings in the fact that when you look at the hard evidence, humans are doing great. They're living longer. They're healthier than they used to be. They're getting wealthier. We live in a peaceful time. I believe these are all good things that deserve celebrating. And most people, a lot of people have trouble accepting it. It's very easy to be a doomsayer. It's hard to recognize good, positive facts. We're not set up that way. And the future I'm now going to describe is even brighter and even more golden. So, you know, let's all be skeptical, but let's also recognize if it is something like this, we're going to be surprised, probably. We're not wired up to say, wow, this is just what I expected. You know, it's better than what we had. And I think it will be better than what we had. I think there's a high probability of that. I wrote my book, Your Next Government, to try to help us through this transition. We're entering a really interesting time in history where there will be a lot of changes. But I think we can navigate this, keeping in mind that we want to maximize consent. That is basically our lodestar to ensuring we're going to move the world and all of us with it to a better place, more consent. And in this more consensual world, I see people opting into the kinds of governments that they want more and more. And people like you and your listeners, James, are going to lead the way because you're talented people who have the guts to move to where opportunities are better. And you are kind of not just like I said earlier, you're kind of like these snowy swans that, you know, fly for thousands of miles, but really also like canaries in a coal mine, right? If the canaries, mm-hmm. the digital nomads show up somewhere and they thrive, that's great. So we're going to have competition between these different zones. I foresee lots of special jurisdictions, like in the Republic of Georgia, the United Arab Emirates. Dubai is not the only place. They're also putting in more in some of the other Emirates, maybe Neom, Honduras, French Polynesia. And once the ball gets rolling, especially if the seasteaders get their game on, the beautiful thing about a seastead is you build them. You build them and you just reach an agreement with some local government so you can put your anchor down. And so we could have digital nomad landing pads floating on the open ocean, floating in places like Malta, pretty nice climate there, all these great places, all connected, of course, by, you know, boat and airplane, but mostly because the VR experience gets so good. People basically stay where they like the weather and their friends are close at hand for a cold beer and they do all their work online. And they're living in jurisdictions they chose, not just climates they chose, not just with the buddies on board that they like, but they're living in jurisdictions that have the laws they like. Because if someone passes a law locally, maybe the local Muslims get a little, you know, upset about those hippies floating out in the lagoon and they pass a more stringent, you know, they back down on their commitment to not interfere with local practices and they pass some anti-marijuana law. You know, if you're a seasetter, you don't have to flip them the bird. That's optional, but mm-hmm. you just leave. And that mm-hmm. kind of effect, competition, as you and people in business know, is the ultimate discipline. And since we're going to have more jurisdictions, we'll have more competition. And the competition is going to start out for people like you and your listeners, but then it's going to spread more. It's kind of this interesting kind of side effect. People who are willing to take the risks first, who are most productive, they get the benefits. They pay the cost. They take the risks first, and they get the benefits first. The first people in the gold fields, the first people on the seastead, and then everybody else comes, and you end up with California, which is where I live, and I like it a lot. So you can act in this. I'll give you an analogy to help this pop a little more. Think about computers. We went from mainframes to operating systems that ran across computers. These early mainframes, every time they wrote one, they had the same operating system. Then they came up with Unix. They had an operating system that worked across mainframes. Then they came up with microcomputers and all these desktops. And think about operating systems like governments. So our governments are still kind of in the mainframe days. We're finally transitioning to this world where the law up and moves. People can kind of choose a law. They can clean it up. They can create their own private legal systems. And that's like people writing new OSs. That's like Windows squaring off against Apple's operating systems. And now what's going to drive that competition is just as we had lots of microcomputers, so Microsoft and Apple competed to have the best OS, we're going to have lots of these little jurisdictions all over the world. And they're going to compete by running operating systems that are not for computers, but for societies. And that's going to help us, just like operating systems have gotten so much better over the years. Our governments are now finally going to face this competition like computer sellers did, and they're going to have to get better. So we're going to have the equivalent of like Apple OSs in government. None of this DMV stuff. It'll be like iTunes if you have to, like, you know, pay your residency fees. So yay, less war, less red tape, better climates. That's what we got coming down the pike in my prediction.
Yeah, there was a book I'm sure you're familiar with, The Diamond Age, is kind of, you know, a lot of people point to that, right? What do you think about the kind of picture that it paints there?
I like it a lot. It's highly entertaining. Neal Stephenson is one of my favorite novelists, frankly. And I love that book. It's funny. I was just talking about it with my research assistant because I'm going to cite it in a recent paper and I haven't read that book for a long time. Well, it is a work of fiction and it's very colorful. That's what I love about Stephenson's work. There's a lot of, you know, chases, explosions, and shootings, and ridiculous, very funny things happen. The real world's mm-hmm. actually going to be, when we get there, quite banal. I mean, I'm a happy guy. I'm excited about what's going on. But today was not, you know, like, wow, fantastic, miraculous things happened. But if you had teleported me here from 1974, I'd be gibbering like an idiot in amazement at the wonder around me that I now am swimming in. And that's how it's going to happen with us, James. Even 15 years down the road, we're going to look up and realize, wow, people used to worry about nuclear war. There was a time when there was this, like, what was it, North Korea? Yeah, when there was still like it was a North Korea. And there was this dude and it was crazy, but I was actually kind of worried. And I wasn't the only guy. Really? Yeah. And it'll just be better. It'll be better. When I was a kid, people routinely on the news talked about people dying, huge crowds, whole populations dying of starvation. I'm not saying it doesn't happen still. That problem has greatly decreased, however. And you know, if you had snapped your fingers 1974 and said, hey, all those people dying in Africa of starvation, we just fixed that, just like that. We'd be weeping tears of joy. As it is, we kind of got here slowly, gradually, thankfully. I don't think we could handle the shock. Such great stuff is coming. I don't know. I mean, think about when they start reversing aging. We got some early signs of that coming down the pike. I really think no reason to think science can't do that. It's just physics. I mean, it's more than just physics. But it doesn't require miracles. Maybe some hard science, but that's solvable. That's going to change a lot. So we got a lot to digest, we humans. A lot of good stuff coming down the pike. I'm happy to say if we handle it right, governments won't be getting in the way. That's all I'm trying for. It's kind of like, can we just not worry about governments so we can get on to more interesting things like medicine and art and what we're really here for?
Right. Well, what I think that we're witnessing now, I'm you know, pretty convinced of this, is that, you know, we've seen a decline in, you know, this age of, you know, very strong nation states, although it doesn't seem to be the case. It's a slow, kind of long, you know, progress of kind of the weakening because of, you know, these overbloated, you could say, welfare states, but also, you know, the defense, just the government in general, and their inability, their increasing inability to, you know, treat their citizens as you know, employees or slaves, to just, you know, continuously extract more and more wealth because of, you know, of technology, because of other things. It's easier for your common man to, you know, act or, you know, use his wealth in the same way that only the wealthy could maybe, you know, 60 years ago or so. And so, you know, the government does have to think about, well, when I extract this amount of money out of that person, they have to pay people and a bureaucracy in order to do it. And that's becoming less and less efficient. And so, you know, I guess the idea is, or the question is, you know, like we have this battle for a while now. The way that I see it is, you know, centralization and decentralization, you know, people really fighting on this centralized model that doesn't seem to be viable. And so, you know, I guess, you know, really what the question is, it's like, is at what point does there need to be like a complete crash or something, you know, like that? Mm-hmm. Or can we just transition into, you know, have some different, better kind of areas that some of us can go, the ones that do see the writing on the wall, maybe we can go and not be as affected as other people.
Yeah, well, let's paint that out, because I'd actually like to get your thoughts on this. I'm writing a paper now, a chapter for a book called Some Futures of Anarchism. I don't consider myself an anarchist. I thought about that a lot when I was much younger. Now I'm just like a pragmatist, I think, with some unusual, you know, ideas, because I have facts other people don't have, frankly. So here's a scenario. For the United States government, which is, you know, arguably the titan of the world, it certainly has the largest defense budget and probably the most fearsome military by a fair stretch, and the wealthiest country, etc. But it is, of course, financially in an unsustainable position and trajectory, and that stuff is going to hit the fan someday. And what could happen is basically the United States government defaults on its debts to its own people, such as retirees and other beneficiaries of its social welfare programs, and also ultimately, of course, to all the beneficiaries of the corporate welfare and defense spending that it engages in. And that could be accelerated by the availability online of an alternative, not just currency like Bitcoin or currencies. Mm-hmm. People could be using Ether, or perhaps there'd be something like Zen, or there's a number of competitors, and competition drives excellence. So we have reason to believe that there will probably be some very convincing, useful, hard to censor, hard to trace cryptocurrencies that are very popular pretty soon. Unless governments can shut them down, which is why I'm going to point out, James, I think very important to the future I'm going to describe is something I heard Vitalik Buterin talking about today on a podcast, the Singularity podcast. I was listening on the way to work. And there he was mentioning some things he kind of is interested in. And one of them, and the first one he mentioned, was mesh networks. And I totally agree, because in a world where our best, really richest, most available exit is not really, frankly, James, like you, up and moving and flying out. That's great, but you're kind of unusual in that regard. That's one of the things that's admirable about you, frankly. But there's a lot of talented people who are restless, who are not going to go to that much trouble. Maybe they got a mother who's sick they have to watch after. It just can't be that heroic. Their ex is going to be online. And so if governments can control, as China has been doing with restless Islamic Muslim regions, can control the infrastructure, it's got us. But if you have a mesh network, such as Vitalik Buterin and others have advocated, then you have people setting up kind of their own infrastructure. With that, then people caught in a failing system, like the United States is likely to be in, say, 25 years, if not earlier, will be able to exit out. They'll be able to go down to the store and pay not in inflated greenbacks, but instead in, you know, whatever cryptocurrency they use to get paid for the coding they did in their living room. Or maybe, you know, they're graphic artists and they just do everything via a high bandwidth connection. They do all that. They actually have kind of what are face-to-face meetings with clients. And you know how all this future stuff plays out, because it's a world you and I are kind of living in. We started out this podcast today. I had the video going and we could have done it that way. That was like magic in 1974. We have it in our laps. And so what will happen is people will exit to this online world. Governance will not go away, but it will change, of course. They're going to care a lot less about whether or not customs are paid on the goods that enter down at the port. They're going to care a lot less about whether workers' comp is being paid, because it's not what they do. They don't even have the payment they get is through some online system. They get their insurance online. If they get sick, they're going to go to a hospital that takes their cryptocurrency. And bit by bit, and this is the future Neil Stephenson basically portrays, the federal government gets squeezed out of business. It's not violent. It could happen more quickly, more slowly. You know, hyperinflation, if that hit hard, boom. But the nice thing is we won't be like Venezuela if we do this at all close to not stupid. I'm not blaming the Venezuelans. I'm not saying they're stupid. But they were stuck with a really ignorant, dumb, violent kind of government. Our government's not that bad. So if we have hyperinflation in the United States, we won't be left without an alternative. Indeed, some Venezuelans, as you know, have kind of turned to Bitcoin. But you have to have a fairly developed infrastructure right now to get that to work. Now, I'll say also mesh networks solve that problem. If we can get mesh networks to work, so it's basically your device communicates with my device, communicates with my neighbor's device, communicates with her neighbor's device, and together we create an internet. We don't do it through some local fiber optic network, which can, you know, have the government squatting on its routers. That allows you to bypass a lot of censorship, and then you can really set up an alternative economy. And the way you escape from statism is kind of the parasites get less and less blood to suck in a way, you know, and then they you don't have to go out and slay them. They just find better opportunities.
It seems like the mesh network, you know, I mean, obviously it seems, it would be great. But don't you think you have to get these big tech companies on board, you know, Apple, Microsoft specifically? In order to implement something like that, because most people, they're not going to be messing around with some open source phones and stuff like that. I mean, how can we cross that bridge? Because it doesn't seem like they're embracing a lot of the crypto stuff and mesh networks and this type of thing.
Well, we are talking to, you know, the mesh networks is in the future. We're talking about the future. It's not here yet. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying the kind of trends that I foresee migration onto the internet for a lot of economic activity. That is hard for status to tax and regulate. It's more likely to happen if we have mesh networks. But I got to say, James, you know, there is a piece. I have my phone right here. I'm holding my hand now. It's an Android, basically. So it's running Linux. It's a Linux kernel. It's part of every Android operating system. And it is the most popular operating system in the world today, even counting laptops. And so it's got open source at its heart. So I think there is some prospect for that kind of technology to have really powerful effects, and it can happen quickly. AOL was once the titan of its day, and poof, gone. These things can happen surprisingly quickly. I almost hope they don't. Things are pretty good now. I'm not saying perfect, but the trend is good. Too much change too fast. People, they drop the balls, and it could get messy. I think the trend is good, though. We're seeing more choice in government. We're having more jurisdictions pop up and more innovation in government. Really, there's really a lot of competition now, and I think it's just going to increase. Dubai has to compete with other Emirates and soon Honduras. The seasteaders could be taking competing governments all over the world very quickly. If very quickly means like 8 years.
Right. Now with Honduras, I mean, you know, I remember there was a time when, you know, there were people that were very upset about the Honduras. You know, there's always people that are against this kind of thing. And, you know, they paint a picture of, oh, you know, the corporations are going to come into the area and kind of enslave everybody or something like that, not pay any taxes. And what do you, for that kind of criticism, how do you respond?
Well, okay, yes, that's a valid concern. And I'll say a couple things. One is people always have concerns about what happens in Honduras, and for good reason. I mean, at root, it is a government program, the SETI program. It's by, for, and about Hondurans. It's their program. And they wouldn't be doing it if everyone was happy with the way the government is run now. It's funny. I work in this field of work. There's a chapter in my book called Stories of the Sort Ordinarily Recounted Over Drinks, in which I talk about working in these interesting places with these interesting clients with these interesting problems. And in this line of work, you're helping people set up special jurisdictions. It's like a doctor. Doctors don't deal with healthy people. You don't need a doctor if you're healthy. And so some of these governments have problems, okay? And there's reasons to complain about how they do things. Mm-hmm. That's why they are frankly trying what is, let's admit, a pretty – what's the word I want to use here? Extreme approach to reform. That's why I admire it, because they won't. I don't want to say they'll admit it, but the rest of us can say, because it's true, they have some problems with governance. Now, specifically to this program, the stuff I've seen is, gosh, so ignorant. I mean, I've been down there. I've been to Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. I've spoken with the author of this plan. I have been to places where they plan to build these ZAs. I have talked with the people who want to develop them. I've talked to people in the communities that mostly seem to welcome this development. And the ignorance I see by commentators, well, I'll just stop. I mean, this is true of all of us, right? Anything that you know firsthand and then reporters get in there, it's just a mess. You see how badly done it is. But here there's a lot of, I think, well-meaning people. They look at Honduras and they think, oh, poor Honduras. Again, they're going to get, you know, they're treated like a colony. They're going to get cheated somehow. Somebody's going to get killed unfairly. And I wish I could say, no, that won't happen. But it's Honduras. They are trying really hard. I think they need our support. I think anybody who wants to know what the ZETI program is like can go read the statute. I actually have made the English translation available. I think my version is kind of – it's not official. There is no official English version, but a lot of people have looked at my version. So it's kind of like open source crowd. It's like a crowded translation. I ran it through Google first, and it had all these native English – native Spanish speakers go over it. And so you can read the statute, the ZETI statute. Just run a search and tell me if you don't find it's impressive. You know, it is just words on paper, but they seem to be trying. Let's just give them a shot is what I say.
Sure. You know, it seems to me like if there was a, you know, one of these set up that was, you know, successful, that allowed, that wasn't necessarily set up just for big companies, but that, you know, people were able to go and live there, maybe start their own businesses and explore different ideas, that it would very quickly come up with lots of new innovations and become very wealthy. And I'm wondering how other countries would, you know, feel or, you know, react to that, because, you know, like you're talking about mesh networks and other types of, I mean, we could go over all kinds of things in the medical industry, in the energy industry, in lots of ways that, you know, people could be experimenting, coming up with new inventions that, you know, frankly, are kind of illegal to do in a lot of the world now. And so, I think that it would, you know, just be quickly be so successful that it would be make most countries look pretty bad. How do you think they'd react to that?
Nothing will happen with any of these projects unless the host country is okay with it. You know, it has to be approved, overseen. The only people who have some prospect of really getting to do whatever they want will be the seasteaders if they make it out in the open ocean.
You know, right.
You notice I haven't really talked about that because technically it's not going to happen. So, I mean, that's something to worry about. And if I were you know, inviting in one of these special jurisdictions to my country, I would make sure all this was controlled. I tell you what the Hondurans do with the ZETI program. They say, I said, as I did, you know, they get control of the ZETIs in the Honduran program over a lot of local law. But one thing I didn't mention, which is true, is not criminal law. They don't get to write their own criminal law. So they don't get to, well, I was going to say legalized prostitution, but actually prostitution is already legal in Honduras. But they're not big fans of drug use. So the drug war kind of has been it's really the United States' fault, frankly. It's a, you know, the drug war in the United States has kind of really hurt Honduras and Mexico and so many other countries. But anyhow, you can't, you know, go around smoking dope in Honduras. And they're not going to let you in a ZA touch that. Well, actually, what they say is you don't get to choose your own criminal code unless it's approved by the National Assembly. So you could, you know, put together a comprehensive legislative – actually, I prepared one, that criminal package, and take it to the legislature and say, can we please have this criminal code? So the National that's what they call it, the National Assembly. That's their, you know, kind of – it's not a parliamentary system, but, you know, it's like their legislature, their Congress. And they would have to say yes to make that effective. So that's the thing that these, that's just an example, James, about how you're absolutely right. That's just something to worry about, that the host country will be, you know, disgusted or upset or frightened by what happens in a special jurisdiction. And, you know, there's, you're right. And there's smart people who think about that and they've come up with kind of ways to control that. They'll probably get some of it wrong, but we'll figure it out as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, again, I think there's probably a lot of people that are listening. This is the first time they've heard these type of ideas. And I know, especially in today's climate, you know, we're in the middle of a lot of this stuff kind of changing, you know, different types of borders being debated and you know, fought about. And, you know, I kind of wanted to say that, you know, I understand. I think you're from the United States, right? You were born there?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, we're both from the United States, and I like the United States, but, you know, there's a lot of kind of people that are kind of digging in their heels at this point and saying, you know, that we're not going to, we need to fight for this United States, and we don't need to go off and, you know, do all this type of stuff. We're getting attacked by, I don't know, whatever, you know, globalism, international corporations, or, you know, other countries or this type of thing. And I don't know, when I just look practically at the way that the direction that we're going, the technology that we have, you know, just the way that the world is now, I really think that, especially like you're saying about, you know, it hitting the fan as far as, you know, with the state in general, a lot of these nation states are just way over indebted. I mean, I don't see any other viable type of solution to this, you know, us moving forward. And not only that, but because of the way that we've advanced, we can now have a free market, or, you know, put certain things that had to be, or maybe they didn't have to be, but they were, and it was much more practical for them to be controlled by the state in the past, that there are a lot more things that it can easily, we can do it voluntarily now. And yeah, so I think that that's the kind of changes, that we're looking at. I do think that, you know, and another thing I wanted to say is that maybe a lot of people are kind of wrapping their head around the idea. You know, another thing is they won't all be the same. You could have different, like you were talking about, if there's an area that's under Sharia law and, you know, you're there, then you could just move out. So yeah, you could have one area that's, you know, there's a lot of people there and they enjoy Sharia law and that's fine. And they can have their area where they do that. And then, there's another area that, you know, has completely different, types of things where people, enjoy different things, maybe because of geography or because of the people that are attracted there. They have different industries. They have different types of people, whether it's culturally or religious or ethnic, whatever. We don't know. So it's not that, you know, everybody's going to be in some homogenized type of culture. It could actually be more diverse. And so, yeah, so I want to kind of give people the right kind of picture for that.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, I kind of agree with your account. I'm not sure what you want me to add to it.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, like I said, I haven't really covered this too much, so I wanted to. I know a lot of people are trying to. Maybe there are people out there kind of scratching their head and wondering what exactly something like that would look like. And like I mentioned earlier, the if, you know, people are interested, they can read the Diamond Age.
Yeah,
it kind of gives a good.
That's funny you mentioned that earlier. You were mentioning Snow Crash, but I actually think Diamond Age is slightly. I love that one too. It's a little more. Can I say it's more optimistic? In a way, it's a little shinier. I like the Vickies, the new Vickies. I think that's not implausible. And your listeners should read if they're interested in this stuff. I understand, James. Mm-hmm. You said this is a little more theoretical than what I usually do. It's not so practical as I don't know whatever. What you usually talk about, getting through customs in Jamaica or whatever.
Making money and money, you know, investing.
But if you're going to, that Stevens is a great way to get theory in a fun package. And both his books, Snow Crash and The Diamond Age, you can mm-hmm. make a plausible case that some of his predictions in Snow Crash have kind of come true, right? He described this metaverse where basically a lot of people, like you and me right now, spend a lot of their time. And Diamond Age, he kind of takes it further. So, yes, to everybody should read that if you want a fun, good, perhaps even useful time looking at the future through a smart guy's eyes.
Okay. All right. Now, to wrap this up, I want to ask you kind of, we've talked about some of the ones that are I don't know how, if you want to say mature, but they've been working on it for a little while. I want to know if there's any that might be coming down the pike that people don't know about, first of all. And also want to know, you know, for somebody that is willing to move, willing to chase opportunity, is there anything specific that you think, you know, especially a young person has, you know, a lot of time to learn a new skill or go somewhere with opportunity? So number one, is there anything that maybe they haven't heard about, cutting edge stuff? And also, what would you recommend for someone that is able to go and follow up on some opportunities produced by these type of places?
I think I kind of already tipped my hand on the best things that I have. Because those are still very far out there. Honduras, French Polynesia, and the Republic of Georgia. But let me think for a second. Well, there is Liberland. There's some talk about them in my book. I guess there I would say there might be some opportunities there. It is a very fluid, uncertain situation in terms of the real politique on the ground. Mm-hmm. At least it was last I studied it closely, and I have not been following it closely.
Sure. Yeah, and it, obviously, you know, a lot of these things are, you know, it's been kind of a struggle for a while to get accepted and getting through all these laws, and that's the way it's going to be. And, you know, it's not always going to be successful. And when you are an entrepreneur, when you are going into some new market, you're doing cutting edge things and not just copying other people, then, you know, that's how it's going to be. Sometimes you have to be agile. You have to pivot. You have to, you know, some things aren't going to work out. But if you want to go, you know, do a 0-to-1 type of thing like Peter Thiel talks about, rather than just copying what everybody else is doing, then it's going to be a little rocky sometimes. It's not always going to be completely successful as you'd like to be. So I think this is definitely a, you know, something, you know, the whole special economic zones and all these types of experimenting with private governance, stuff like that. I think it's something that we need to keep an eye on, especially for young people, because this is stuff that's definitely going to be implemented in our lifetimes, you know, different parts of it, and we're going to see lots of different things like this. And so, you know, it's good to get educated on it and that kind of thing. You know, following your work is good, and you know, going out and getting the book, Your Next Government, From Nation State to Stateless Nations. Associations or nations, however it is. But
you get the first words, you got it right. Your Next Government, you'll get it right.
Yeah. So definitely go check out that book if you're interested in that, and also Tom's other book about intellectual property. Thanks so much, Tom, for coming on. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add to that.
No, I'll just say thanks for having me on your podcast, and look forward to seeing you in that glorious future, which I've now kind of committed myself to.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much. It's been great.
Thanks for joining us for the Borderless Podcast, traveling, investing, and living beyond borders.